Shrugging out of the hospital gown, Heather tossed it into the corner, stretched her naked body tall and erect, and filled her lungs with air. Then, breathing out slowly, she shifted into her first yoga pose of the morning. Warrior One.
Chapter 77. Constitution Avenue was crowded with cars. The Washington Mall was packed with people. The early evening was hot and muggy, and some damned country singer roamed the Capitol stage wailing about how rednecks could survive. Freddie shook his head. He hated these July 4th celebrations. It was just like the government to make a special exception to martial law rules in order to squeeze in such a self-congratulatory ceremony during these hard times. He'd seen enough red, white, and blue backdropped fireworks augmented performances to last two lifetimes. But here he was at another. On top of that, his walking leg was rubbing a blister on what was left of his stump. But Tallbear's message had said to be here, so here he was. If he'd been thinking, he'd have brought a blanket to spread out on the lawn along with a cooler full of Bitburger pills. Glancing around at the security squads roaming through the crowd, Freddy doubted he could have slipped it in. Something bumped hard against Freddy's good leg, almost toppling him. He looked around in time to see two fat blonde kids chasing each other through the crowd, weaving in and out of seated groups of people, several expressing the annoyance Freddy felt. Maybe the little porkers would pass out in the Washington heat. He glanced at his watch. 6:15 p.m. Tallbear's message had said 6 o'clock. So where the hell was he? Freddy moved a little farther south, his eyes scanning the Capitol steps. No sight of the big Indian cop. At his height and with that long raven hair, he should have been easy to spot, even in this mob. Freddy spun in a slow circle, shielding his eyes from the sinking sun as he gazed westward toward the white spire of the Washington Monument. A flock of birds rose up from the cherry trees near the Jefferson Memorial, their whirling mass swooping across the green expanse of the mall, briefly eclipsing the bright orange orb before settling into some trees beside Constitution Avenue. Freddy was glad he hadn't parked over there. If anything, the crowd on the mall was getting bigger as people maneuvered for spots they wanted for tonight's fireworks show. Looking out at the scene, Freddy could almost convince himself that all was well with the country. But D.C. was a heavily protected green zone, at least this part of D.C. The Army, Marines, and National Guard had done a good job of expanding the number of areas under their control, but that still left large sections of the country subject to something approaching anarchy. Louisiana had been written off as not worth the effort to police, and many of the nation's sparsely populated rural areas had reinterpreted martial law as militia law, maintaining local order at the expense of civil rights. Poor inner-city neighborhoods resembled war zones that police feared to enter and the army regarded as non-essential. On the stage, the country band finished its set, thanked the crowd, and exited stage right, replaced by a congressman from the great state of Maryland. Freddy tuned him out and resumed his search. Frustrated, he jostled through the crowd toward the Capitol building. Maybe if he stood on the steps, Tallbear would find him. 30 minutes of standing proved him wrong. "Screw this," he muttered, turning to head back toward Union Station and his car. The thought of his car brought his hand to his pocket. Freddy froze. His car keys were gone. He checked his hip pocket and breathed out a small sigh of relief. At least he had his wallet. But how the hell had he lost his keys? Instinctively, he patted all his pockets, surprised to feel the key ring bulge in his front left pants pocket. What the hell? He never put his keys in that pocket. Reaching his left hand in to grab them, he felt something else with them. A piece of paper. Extracting his keys and the paper, Freddy stared down at it. The paper was a neatly folded piece of heavy vellum. It reminded him of something he'd seen before, although he couldn't place it. Glancing around, Freddy saw nothing out of the ordinary. But someone in the crowd had picked his pocket, then returned his keys along with a note, in a way sure to get his attention. Staring down at the paper, Freddy undid the four folds. As he stared at the handwriting, the sense of déjà vu enveloped him so strongly it took his breath away. "This is the second note I've sent you, although the first in my own name. You may recall a certain shoebox and necklace that accompanied the first. Be assured, if I wanted to harm you, you'd already be dead. You have some information I want, and I believe I can fill in part of the story you're currently working. If you're interested, be at the southeast corner of Louisiana and New Jersey at 7:15. I'll find you. J.G. A cold shiver started at the base of Freddy's neck, radiating up his scalp and down his arms like the kiss of death. Jack Gregory. Somehow in the midst of all this hyper-security, the Ripper had touched him twice and he hadn't even noticed, despite the fact he'd been actively studying his surroundings. Freddy folded the note and returned it to his pocket along with his keys, then, with another quick glance around, crossed Constitution Avenue onto First. Taking a slight right onto Louisiana, he made his way past the Taft Memorial, reaching the southeast corner of Louisiana and New Jersey Avenues. His watch said 7:08. A black Honda Shadow motorcycle squealed to a stop beside him. The rider's face, hidden behind the helmet's reflective faceplate, turned toward him. Freddy nodded. "You're early. Get on." To Freddy's credit, he never hesitated, at least not for longer than it took him to get his good leg over the seat behind Gregory. The motorcycle pulled into traffic, turned left on New Jersey, leaving the Union Station Plaza behind as it accelerated northeast. 2 hours later, Freddy found himself in Linethicum, Maryland, sitting on a couch in Jack Gregory's room at the BWI Homewood Suites. "Coffee?" Gregory asked, lifting the in-room pot. "Black." Setting a steaming cup in front of Freddy, Gregory filled his own mug, then settled into the armchair across from the sofa. Freddy didn't know what he'd been expecting from the killer, but this wasn't it. At the moment, the man looked nothing like any of the pictures Freddy had seen of him, and they'd been all over the television and print media. His ruddy brown complexion and medium-length coal-black hair gave him a distinctly Native American look that went fine with his jeans, boots, and western shirt. Gregory moved in a relaxed, easy fashion that reminded Freddy of a prowling lion. Freddy just hoped he'd make it through the evening without becoming the prey. Well, so far so good.
"You're meeting with Dr. Sigmund on the night she killed herself. Tell me about it."
Freddy sucked in a breath, his heart rate shifting up a notch. How did Gregory know about that? Not through his old NSA ties. Those were as dead as Jonathan Riles. A light dawned in his mind. Tall Bear.
"What do you want to know?"
"Why you arranged the meeting, everything Dr. Sigmund told you, your thoughts and impressions about what she was telling you, why she killed herself. Everything."
"Why should I tell you when I didn't tell the NSA? Your note mentioned a quid pro quo."
Jack reached for the fruit basket on the coffee table, grabbed a shiny red apple, and slowly began peeling it. Freddy hadn't noticed when the survival knife had appeared in his hand, but there it was, the thin red apple skin curling away from the black blade in one long, thin strip.
"I've read your investigative work. Impressive stuff. You show me that same level of attention to detail, and I'll reciprocate."
"And if I don't?"
"Then you'll find the front page a little sooner than you planned."
Freddy remembered a line his father had told him. "Son, don't ask a question if you don't want to hear the answer."
Freddy Hagerman shrugged.
"Fair enough."
At 2:30 a.m., Jack Gregory leaned over and handed Freddy the room's keycard, then rose and walked out the door. A minute later,
Freddy heard the roar of a motorcycle as it pulled out of the parking lot and drove off. As exhausted as Freddy was, he felt no inclination to sleep. Instead, he stared down at his digital recorder, the one he'd played for Gregory earlier in the evening, the one on which he'd subsequently been allowed to record the Ripper's narrative. "Jackie boy, now that's one hell of a story."
Chapter 78. Jan Collins finished printing the vehicle pass, handed it to the government contractor waiting on the other side of the white counter, and pressed the button that incremented the now-serving display.
"Number 207?
She called out, as a middle-aged man arose from one of the blue upholstered chairs that filled the waiting area and limped toward her station, a pink-numbered slip of paper in his fingers.
"How may I help you?"
"Need a one-day vehicle pass."
"You could have gotten a one-day pass from the Reese Road security guards. You really didn't need to come inside the visitor control center."
"Damn, so I wasted 20 minutes in line?" Jan smiled.
"Looks like. But since you're already here, I can issue the pass. I'll need your driver's license, ID card, registration, and proof of insurance."
"It's a rental car."
"Then I'll need to see the rental agreement."
The man laid the documents on the counter along with a retired military ID card. Jan looked through the papers, made a few entries in her computer, and compared the face on the card to that of the man who stood before her. 6 feet tall, hair beginning to gray at the temples. He looked to have packed on a few pounds since the ID card had been issued. The brown eyes were the same, though, as was the man's disarming smile. Something about his eyes made her uncomfortable. Then again, maybe it was just the humidity that had her edgy today.
"And the reason for your visit?"
"Just stopping by to see an old friend who's stationed here."
"Okay, Major Hansen," she said, handing him the printed vehicle pass. "Stick that on your dashboard and you're good to go."
"Thanks."
Hansen picked up the pass, smiled, and limped toward the door. Jan pressed the button, advancing the count. Glancing at the board, she saw that Sheila, the lady who worked at the next station, had already finished 2 people while she had helped the retired major. Raising her voice, Jan called for her next customer.
"Number 210, come on down."
Chapter 79. Jack Gregory limped through the small parking lot outside the Demps Visitor Control Center, clicked the unlock button on the red Camry's key fob, opened the door, and slid into the driver's seat. The clock read 10:25 a.m., and it was already hot enough to make the facial and body disguises uncomfortable. Starting the engine, Jack pulled back out onto Reese Road, getting into the line of cars stopped before the security gate. The black-clad security guards were contractors, commonly used at American military bases to free up soldiers for war-fighting missions. As he flashed his retired military ID, the guard took it, looked through the window at his vehicle pass, and then motioned him to pull forward into a vehicle inspection lane.
"Pop your trunk and hood, open your glove box, step out of the car and open all the doors."
Jack did as instructed, stepping back to allow the inspectors to do their work. While one guard slid a long mirror under the vehicle, the other made his way around the car, looking in the engine compartment, inside the open doors, and in the trunk.
"Okay, you're clear."
Jack nodded. Then he closed up everything he'd opened, slid into the driver's seat, and began his leisurely drive onto Fort Meade proper. Turning left on Rose Street, he drove behind the PX and commissary, taking a left into the Burger King parking lot. Might as well grab a little brunch before the place packed up with the lunchtime crowd. After that, he figured he'd check out the PX and commissary, hit the National Cryptologic Museum, maybe even stop off at the base library. Might as well enjoy a leisurely day. After all, he had 10 hours to kill. The items hidden inside the hollowed-out back seat cushions would have to wait until dark. 2,300 hours on the dot. Jack backed the Camry into the open parking slot at the Sleep Inn and swiped his key card in the side door, feeling the cool breath of air conditioning fight back the outside humidity as he stepped into the carpeted corridor that led to his room. The faint smell of mildew didn't bother him. The hotel was clean and well-kept. Besides, it was damned hard to keep all traces of mildew out of a Maryland hotel in summer. His room was a ground-floor suite he'd rented by the week, nicely appointed, as these mid-priced hotels went. It had a fridge, microwave, coffee pot, and couch. The coffee table wasn't anything fancy, but it beat eating at the desk. The shower had good water pressure, and the bed was comfortable. All in all, not bad mission accommodations. Slipping out of his shirt, Jack unhooked the midriff fat suit, tossed it and his shoulder holster on the bed, and walked into the bathroom. When he walked out again 20 minutes later, he was tan, blonde, and naked. If not for the crazy quilt of scars that covered his torso, he could have passed for a member of the Australian Olympic beach volleyball team. He walked over to the dresser, stepped into a pair of striped boxers and a Baltimore Ravens t-shirt, grabbed a Diet Coke from the fridge, and sat down in front of the laptop waiting on the desk. It was a basic black Toshiba laptop he'd picked up at Best Buy last week for $427. Good enough to serve his purpose, but not worth stealing. Pressing the recessed power button, Jack leaned back, cracked open the pop top on the Coke, and lifted the not-quite-frosty can to his lips. Not great, but about the best you could expect from a hotel mini-fridge. 3 miles down the road, Heather, Mark, and Jennifer were locked inside separate cells at the top-secret NSA Supermax facility, codenamed the Ice House, buried deep beneath an underground parking garage adjacent to the Black Glass headquarters. While the Bleeding Hearts complained about prisoners kept at Guantanamo, they had no idea that the worst terrorists were housed at the secret prison laboratory at Fort Meade, a facility constructed with funds from the black budget, a place where the oldest coercion methods were mingled with the latest experimental data extraction techniques. Jack knew the place like the back of his hand, had taken part in many of those sanctioned interrogations. Ironically, the NSA thought it now held 3 young people who could help it find the Ripper. What it didn't know was that it had the real prize, the most dangerous trio on the planet. And as far as Jack was concerned, that even included Dr. Donald Stevenson. It was only a matter of time until those highly trained and augmented young operatives took that place apart, irrespective of the world's most sophisticated security systems. Jack wasn't worried about that. When it happened, it would be like taking candy from a baby. Jack was here to make sure nobody realized just how dangerous those 3 were. As the laptop finished booting, Jack logged in, then plugged an SRT dongle into one of its USB slots. Holding down Control-Alt-Y, he launched the application that gave him access to the Fort Meade Military Police wiretap he'd installed 2 hours earlier. Although he was now tethered to this hotel room for the next few weeks, he had all the groceries he'd need for the virtual stakeout. One thing he knew. When the shit hit the fan, all that C4 he'd strategically placed around Fort Meade was going to go a long way toward making the government believe Al-Qaeda was back in the U.S. terrorist business. Hopefully that, plus a little luck, would make them miss the obvious. Jack picked up the telephone, glanced at the number written in blue ink on the hotel notepad, and dialed. Hearing the expected response on the far end, he began speaking. "This is Carl Kroner in room 127 at the Sleep Inn in Laurel. I'd like a large Brooklyn-style pepperoni and mushroom. For delivery. Cash. No. That's it. Thanks." Chapter 80. Mark had been waiting for 13 hours for some kind of reaction to tearing down the closed-circuit camera. But it was as if no one even noticed. At 6 p.m., a bouncing flashlight beam preceded a guard down the dark corridor. The circle of light danced as the man shoved a food tray under the door, then moved on without ever shining on Mark. The light and the footsteps retreated. In the distance, a heavy door opened, then slammed shut. The darkness once again complete. Moving to retrieve the food, Mark lifted the tray to smell its contents. The odor wasn't unpleasant, but it wasn't good either. It was the smell of his standard meal. Mark knew the tray held the bland meat and vegetable mush that provided sufficient nutrients to keep him alive, while depriving him of the basic pleasure of eating. It was another aspect of his solitary confinement sensory deprivation regime. But he was hungry, so he ate. With his fingers, Mark shoveled the stuff into his mouth until every morsel was gone. Then he licked the tray clean. Holding it out in front of him, Mark let the tray fall. The clatter radiated out from the point of impact, the bright sound waves bouncing off the walls, the bars, the sink, the toilet, the corridor, his augmented brain processing the reflected echoes into a three-dimensional color image. It was beautiful, far better than his Spartan surroundings looked through his eyes. Mark had seen infrared satellite images of the Earth, where reds and yellows indicated warmer waters sandwiched by cold blues and purples. But this was different, producing lush, real-time 3D imagery in which the echoes enabled him to see around corners and, to some extent, through walls. It didn't take the clatter of the tray to produce the effect, but the volume the tray provided made everything much brighter. Mark smiled. They could keep him in the dark, but they couldn't keep him from seeing if he needed to. He picked up the tray and slid it through the slot out into the hallway, then retrieved his clothes from where he'd hung them on the sink to dry. His touch found them damp, but dry enough for his body heat to finish the job, so he slipped into the orange PJs and sat down against the far wall. For the first time in weeks, Mark felt the urge to let sleep claim him, to let his conscious mind slip away into that vast nothingness where time had no meaning, into a dream world of his subconscious mind's making. The thought settled over him like a fuzzy blanket on a winter night, an enticing siren's call to lie back on the floor and sleep. But what was wrong with that? There were no more interrogators torturing or drugging him for information. No reason to stay alert. Besides, he could bring himself back to full strength at a moment's notice. It happened so rapidly, Mark barely noticed. As easily as he slipped into his meditations, his consciousness melted away around him. He didn't think he was supposed to feel things while dreaming. But he felt this. A familiar nudge, like a sharp elbow in his side. When was the last time he'd felt it? A lifetime ago. His father's garage in White Rock. Jennifer had been at the workbench with Heather. Mark had just finished making one of his brotherly jibes designed to get under Jennifer's skin, and Heather had dug her strong, sharp elbow into his shoulder. There it was again. Not really in his shoulder, but something about the feeling reminded him of Heather. He turned to see her, but a mist shrouded his vision. He thought he could just make out her outline, but when he tried to reach out for her, she faded away. Mark stopped trying, letting the dream current carry him along. The command deck on the bandolier ship materialized around him, his body enfolded by one of the four supple couches. Smoothly curving walls dissolved around him, leaving Mark hurtling through space, just like the first time he'd tried on the alien headset. They'd all tried on the alien headsets, Heather, Jennifer, and Mark. And in that state, they'd established a common link that enabled them to share each other's thoughts and feelings. It was one of the things Jack had encouraged them to explore. It was one of the things they'd all learned to block. But if he was linked into the ship, where were Heather and Jen? And where was the ship's AI that had attacked his mind? He'd thrown up every block he could muster to try to protect them all from that attack. Mark ran through a quick mental diagnostic. Apparently, after releasing all his rage at the AI, he'd restored his own mental shields and left them in place.
Maybe that was why he couldn't feel the girl's presence through his headset. Remembering how it felt to touch Heather's beautiful mind, Mark dropped his mental defenses. The vision of himself hurtling through the vast emptiness of space achieved a new level of clarity. So many stars in the blackness, tiny pinpoints of light, pulsing with an energy all their own. He could feel their energy ripples softly brush his awareness. Suddenly, the surrounding space-time warped violently as a powerful vibration distorted the blackness. In a rush of realization, Mark knew. He wasn't alone anymore.
Chapter 81.
She had him. The rush of joy almost broke the nascent mental link, but Heather wasn't about to let that happen. She opened herself completely, and their minds flowed together. As frightened as she'd been of letting Mark invade her innermost sanctuary, she now welcomed the sharing of all that was right and wrong about her. Neither was she repelled by Mark's dark thoughts and embarrassments. After all, that mixture of good and evil, beauty and ugliness, was a big part of what it meant to be human.
"I love you," Mark's thoughts whispered in her mind.
Funny. Despite how they shared each other's thoughts, mental conversation still came most naturally. "Right back at you," Heather felt Mark smile at her response. "Always have. Just didn't know how much."
"How'd you manage the mind link without our headsets?"
"Jen led me to it. I would have managed sooner if I hadn't tried to overanalyze it."
"You made my day. I've missed you."
Heather's eyes welled up.
"Me too. But I feel you now."
"So you ready to get the hell out of here?"
"I'm working on a plan."
"They've turned on the laptops, at least one of them."
A vision of Mark typing commands into the stolen cell phone played in their joint minds. The fact that the laptops had been turned on meant every electronic system in the building now had multiple back doors through which Heather, Mark, or Jen could take control of the system.
"We'll need access to a networked computer. I need a facilities layout so I can see exactly where each of us is being held. Jennifer's been playing her mind tricks with one of her handlers, but they're drugging her so heavily she's been fading in and out."
Heather felt Mark scan her memory, his anger a gathering storm.
"Heroin? They're intentionally addicting her?"
"You thought they'd play nice?"
"Guess not. Still makes me mad as hell."
"That's fine. Use it. But don't let it use you. Our chance is coming. One other thing. I think Jack's nearby."
"How do you know?"
"I don't, but it's what my visions tell me. I think he's out there waiting for us to make our move, putting himself in a supporting position."
"And if we can't break out?"
"Like I said, our chance is coming."
For 2.5 hours, Heather laid out the details of what she had in mind, refining the plan with Mark's feedback, playing through the scenarios in such vivid detail that they both experienced the same dream world rehearsals. But to make the scenarios complete, she was going to need a completely accurate layout. And she wasn't likely to get that until their break was already underway. Mentally exhausted, Heather terminated the last vision. As she felt her hold on their link fade away, Mark's final thoughts brought a tired smile to her lips.
"So we're just going to wing it. Sounds like my kind of plan."
Chapter 82.
"You with me, Jen?"
Heather's mind reached out for her friend.
"Better than most days. Worse than some."
Indeed, Heather felt far less haze in Jen's mind than she'd felt in several days.
"Jen, I need you to get as much clarity as you can for the next few minutes, even if it costs you later."
Heather knew that the effort of shunting the heroin effects away for a while would inflict a heavy penalty on Jennifer once she relaxed from the effort, as if she had endured a sudden overdose. Heather knew it, hated it, but asked her to do it anyway. She didn't need to ask twice. All at once, Heather felt Jen's mind reacquire its normal cutting edge. That was good. The opportunity stood in front of her right now, but in 5 minutes, it would be gone. "Okay, Jen, in a few seconds, I'm going to want you to do your thing, but you'll need to follow my thoughts and do it through me."
"Sounds like fun. Let's go for it."
Heather relaxed back into the real world, feeling Jen like a hitchhiker in her mind. Dr. Jacobs detached the last of the sticky electrodes from her temples, wound up the cords, and returned them to their case. As he turned to place the items back on his cart, Heather focused on what she needed, felt Jen pick up the thoughts, and then almost lost consciousness as a wave of vertigo carried her into Dr. Jacobs' head. It wasn't like anything she'd ever experienced. Although she'd touched Jennifer's memories, she hadn't wanted to pry into that part of her mind. Certainly this was nothing like the psychic link she shared with Jen and Mark. This was an empathic bond that gave access to the target's innermost feelings. On the surface, Dr. Jacobs seemed very happy with his perceived progress. But beneath that lay a raging sexual urge to do things to his patient that would never be sanctioned by his bosses. If only he could be alone with her for an hour without that damned camera. Like a tick, Jennifer burrowed into that feeling, amplifying the sick urge and feeding it back into Jacobs' mind. The doctor turned toward Heather, stepping close to where she lay so that his body blocked the camera's view. Sliding his stethoscope over his ears, he leaned down.
"Take a deep breath and hold it," he said, sliding the cold end of the device beneath her gown, his hands gently resting against the curve of her breast. Once again, Jennifer amped up the man's hidden desire. "Now let it out. Slowly."
Heather complied, feeling his hand move a little farther up the curve of her left breast, a tremor passing through it as he paused.
"Now, once more."
Again, his hand shifted, and again Jennifer ratcheted up his excitement. Suddenly, his eyes closed as a shudder passed through his body. When they reopened, he frowned, withdrew the stethoscope, turned, and hurriedly pushed the cart to the door. When he pressed his hand to the biometric reader, the electronic lock opened, then locked behind him again as he backed the cart into the corridor. Then, with the squeak of rubber wheels on concrete, he was gone. Heather glanced up, then rolled onto her side, away from the camera. As she felt Jennifer slip back into her drug-induced haze, Heather's fingers stroked the touchpad of Dr. Jacobs's Android cell phone. Chapter 83. The worm was designed to penetrate security holes in Windows, Linux, Solaris, AIX, HP UX, Mac OS, OS 2, Android, Palm, and iOS. It mutated using an evolving genetic algorithm, opened multiple root-level back doors, mapped the host system's routing tables, services, and attached devices, then hid itself to await external commands. It didn't do much, but what it did well. It provided one additional service that Heather immediately brought into play. It opened a telnet port that provided remote shell access to every network-accessible infected system. While she lay curled into a fetal position beneath the sheet, Heather's fingers flew across the tiny cell phone keyboard, scrolling through a list of nearby hosts and routers. One by one, she accessed the systems, made a quick check of attached or networked devices, then moved on. She calculated the odds that Dr. Jacobs would discover his missing cell phone within an extended time window. Jennifer's subtle manipulation of the man's suppressed urges had left him with sticky underwear, shocked and embarrassed, so mentally flustered he just wanted to get someplace he could shower himself clean. If he used an on-site shower facility, a 98% probability,
she might have as little as 30 minutes before he discovered the missing phone. Heather had set her mental clock on a 30-minute countdown. It now stood at 24 minutes, 11 seconds, and counting. Heather knew the facility had been designed with multiple layers of tempest cages, but she knew something else, too. Dr. Jacobs collected data from his cell wirelessly. He also used Wi-Fi from his cell phone to network to his office. That meant the tempest integrity of the lower levels was floor by floor, connected with other floors via secure fiber. And she didn't need to wirelessly connect to the primary control center. She just had to be able to wirelessly access a computer that was linked to that local area network. Heather stared at the small screen, feeling a sudden burst of exhilaration. She'd found it, a route to the security system that controlled the door locks. As happy as that made her, she had to find one more node before she could override that system. It would do little good to take control of the locks if they could watch her every move through the network of cameras. The camera in her cell had a coax cable connection. That meant the other security cameras were probably hooked into the monitoring system the same way. You could bet the same contractor installed the whole shooting match. If that were true, they would show up as directly controlled devices on some system. But even if some of the cameras were smarter, network-enabled devices, she could still take control of them. There would still be a central computer that sent out the IP commands that told them what to do and that routed the video streams to the appropriate clients. 20 minutes, 34 seconds. An adrenaline surge almost caused her to roll to a sitting position. Heather funneled the feeling into a big smile. Gotcha. She didn't need long. 5 minutes, maybe less. Just enough time to get from her cell to the nearest room with some more capable, networked computer systems. Time enough to take out any resistance and get up on the local area network. Heather entered the commands to force an immediate shutdown of the camera control system, switched telnet targets, and unlocked all electronically locked doors throughout the facility, forcing a reboot of the security control system. Then, to add just a bit more confusion to the coming mayhem, she killed the facility lights. Not the power, just the lights. As the lights went out, Heather leaped from her bed, pulled the heavy cell door open, and hit the corridor at a dead run. Although the sound wasn't loud enough to provide a bright image, the echoes from her running footfalls provided enough detail for her to clearly see her surroundings. She didn't need louder sounds. She wanted to see the sounds made by others. Taking a right into the first hallway, Heather saw a flashlight beam stab from the opening door on her left. The look of pain and surprise on the guard's face barely registered as Heather's spinning sidekick broke his arm at the elbow, sending the flashlight flying, the beam whirling through the dark quarter like a Jedi lightsaber before smashing out on the concrete floor. Then, like a lioness, she was on him. Chapter 84. Bud Jendal stared at the bank of security monitors that all displayed the same message. Video source disconnected.
What the hell just happened to our feed?
John McCall, his night shift partner, looked at him and shrugged.
Looks like the system just rebooted. Gotta love Microsoft.
Then the lights went out.
Shit! Power's down too?
Can't be. The computer's coming back up now.
Sure enough, the security and computer monitors still wept their pale light into the encroaching darkness. Weird. Bud didn't like weirdness. Not in the NSA's most secret supermax facility. Not on his shift. Grabbing the heavy black flashlight from its wall mount, John switched it on and headed toward the door.
I'll check it out.
As John stepped into the quarter, a loud crack accompanied his scream. A rush of adrenaline coursed through Bud's body like an electric shock, throwing the unfolding scene into slow motion, the flashlight spinning out of John's hand, the whirling flashlight strobing the action into a sequence of freeze-frame images. The McFarlane girl's cold, hard face, eyes gone white.
John's right arm flopping like a rag doll's. McFarland catapulting John's 240 pounds of muscle toward him like a human cannonball. Bud was halfway to his feet, hand tugging the Beretta from his service holster, when John hit him. Rolling with the blow, Bud came back to his feet with a grace that spoke to his years of training. Even as he sought to level the gun, the girl's axe kick knocked it from his hand, the force of the blow numbing his arm from the shoulder down. Bud responded with a leg sweep that should have landed her flat on her back, but she countered, using his own momentum against him, her elbow smashing his left orbital socket, wiping his vision with a red haze of blood and pain. As the floor rose up to meet him, her knee interrupted his downward progress, the impact crushing his trachea and rupturing several branches of his inferior thyroid artery. As Bud felt blackness enfold him, he realized the unthinkable. This slender young woman in her blue hospital gown had just taken him and John out. As easy as putting out the trash.
Chapter 85.
A quick pulse check confirmed what Heather's visions had already told her. She was this room's sole survivor. Shunting aside a wave of revulsion, Heather let her training propel her forward. Moving quickly, Heather retrieved both guards' duty belts, holsters, and pistols, closed the door, and slid into the chair recently occupied by the second guard. As she used the back door to bypass the login screen, Heather heard the wail of an alarm, accompanied by distant shouts and the muffled thumps of gunfire. It took her 20 seconds to bring the camera controller back online and another 18 to take root control of that system. Overriding the default settings, Heather rerouted all camera output to her station, displaying the live video in a grid of small windows spread across the security monitors. A quick glance told her what she needed to know. Heather pulled up a three-dimensional facility diagram, then three additional windows on the primary computer display, rerouting all facility controls to her terminal. Noting Mark's and Jennifer's locations, she engaged every other lock in the building, restored the lights, and initiated the central control center's fire suppression system, flooding the locked room with Halon 1301. Apparently the NSA was exempt from the EPA global warming ban on Halon fire suppression systems. Not that it mattered to Heather which fire suppression gas they used. Fire wasn't the only thing it would suffocate. She couldn't have someone trying to restore central system control while she had work to do. On a different sublevel, 24 Arabic prisoners had stormed from their cells, killing 3 guards, but losing 5 of their own in the process. Now armed with pistols, nightsticks, and flashlights, the survivors were systematically working their way down the corridor. Ground floor cameras showed that the facility rapid response force, deprived of video intelligence, had broken up into 3 teams of 5 that moved to secure the elevator shaft and stairwells. With a deep breath, Heather shifted her attention to Mark and Jennifer. They were being held on the 3rd sublevel, just like Heather, but in separate wings. As they'd planned, both twins had remained in their cells, awaiting Heather's contact. Now that she had a chance to devote the required level of concentration, Heather opened her mind to Mark and Jen.
"Ah, there you are."
She felt Mark's relief wash through her.
"You ready to move? Just been waiting on you. Jen?" "She's out of it again. I'm gonna have to go get her. You got a layout for me?"
Heather pulled forth the memory of the 3D facility diagram.
"That'll work. I'll unlock the doors along your route as you get to them, then lock them again behind you. Get moving."
Heather dropped the link, refocusing her attention on the monitor showing Mark leaving his cell, then entering another camera's field of view as he raced down the corridor. Movement on the first monitor attracted her attention. One security squad had entered the elevator, headed down to her level. She stopped it between the 1st and 2nd sublevels, killing all power to the elevator shaft, simultaneously sealing all doors shut. It wouldn't keep a determined team from climbing down and forcing the doors open, but it would slow them down. Reconsidering her action, Heather restored power and the elevator's downward motion, injecting a slight error into the elevator controls. Instead of stopping on sublevel 3, it continued its descent to sublevel 4. As the doors opened, the security team suddenly found itself engaged in an all-out Al-Qaeda firefight. Chapter 86. Jack listened to the military police alert go out, paused just a moment to confirm the location, and then reached for the remote device controller. Something big was going down at the top-secret NSA detention facility codenamed the Ice House. Initial reports indicated a group of high-level Al-Qaeda detainees had initiated an escape attempt, resulting in a call for all units to converge on the facility. Well, if they thought this was Al-Qaeda-initiated, Jack was happy to help support that theory. Checking the radio signal strength to each of the 5 remote devices, Jack flicked the first switch to the arm position, waited for the green light, pressed the detonate button, and waited. The blast wave arrived 17 seconds later, strong enough to rattle the windows. Now the MPs were going to have to get organized without any radio communications. Flipping the second switch to arm, Jack repeated the procedure and was once again rewarded with a delayed blast wave. So much for the main telephone trunk lines off base, too. The image of Janet slipped, unbidden, through his mind. Little Robbie perched on one hip as she stood beneath the jungle hut's thatched overhanging roof, waving at him as he'd turned for one last long look at her. He missed his lover. He missed his partner. Getting up from his chair, Jack walked to the sink and started a fresh pot of coffee brewing. The next 3 blasts needed a delay for maximum effect. 1 cup of Java ought to just about do it. Chapter 87. The shock wave shattered the window, showering the bedroom with shards of glass. General Balls Wilson rolled out of bed, cutting his bare feet as he stood up. "Was that a bomb?" His wife's frightened voice helped clear the last of the sleep from his head.
"It's okay, Maggie. It wasn't that close."
His hand reached for the light, then paused as he thought better of it.
"Just stay in bed. I'll get your slippers. Then I want you to walk down to the basement and stay there until I say different. Understand?"
"I understand."
This time her voice was steady. She hadn't spent all those years as an Air Force officer's wife without learning how to stay calm in tough situations. He took a step and cut his foot again, cursing himself for leaving his own slippers in the closet. As he reached the closet door, a second blast shook the room, this one more distant and from a different direction from the first. Jesus H. Christ, the goddamn base was under attack. The realization lent speed to his actions as he tossed his wife's slippers onto the bed, picked out the embedded glass slivers, and slid his bleeding bare feet into his Class A dress shoes.
"Get on down to the basement."
"I'm on my way."
He felt her arms encircle his neck as her lips brushed his left ear.
"Stay safe. I love you."
"I'll be fine. I love you too. Now go."
General Wilson walked over to the phone and lifted it to the ear on which Maggie's kiss still lingered. No dial tone. Picking up the mobile SATCOM phone, Balls pressed the first number on the speed dial list, listening to the hiss and warble as it established the secure connection.
"This is General Wilson. What the hell's going on?"
"Sir, this is John Briggs. We don't know the extent of the problem yet, but we got a report of an attempted prison break underway in the Ice House, followed by 2 explosions. We don't know exactly where they came from, but someone's taken out military police communications and the main phone lines. For some reason, they haven't gone after the power yet. Any comms, intercepts? We've got no chatter, nothing."
Balls didn't like that answer.
"Doesn't make sense."
"No, sir. This kind of Al-Qaeda attack would need some kind of advanced coordination.
If it's Al-Qaeda.
Pretty much has to be. At least, that's the view here in the skiff."
"Who do you have on shift tonight?"
Levi's here with the regular night crew analyst and staff.
Balls felt a wave of relief course through his brain. If Levi Elias was there, they'd get this figured out. Hopefully, in time to stop whoever had started all this from achieving their operational objectives.
Anyone called the president yet? We were trying to get you first. Good plan. I'm on my way in. If I'm not there in 5 minutes, tell Levi to make the call. Roger.
Balls disconnected the call and set the SATCOM phone back in its cradle. As he stood in the darkness beside his bed, buck naked except for his dress shoes, blood oozing up between his toes, he listened to the warble of distant sirens, trying to wrap his brain around the problem. Then, three more explosions shook the building. As the shock waves subsided, the urgency of getting back to NSA headquarters pounded the general's head. Glancing down, another thought struck Balls Wilson. Maybe I ought to put on some pants.
Chapter 88.
Heads up,
Heather's voice whispered in his mind. Detecting sudden movement from the corner of his eye, Mark hurled himself to his left, his legs driving him toward this new threat. The boom of the 9mm pistol accompanied the hiss of a bullet that bounced off the wall behind him. An Arabic fighter wielded the Beretta in a double-handed crouch. As he tried to adjust his aim, Mark slid feet first along the floor, his right leg pistoning up into the man's crotch, launching him into the ceiling, 4 feet up. Two other men rounded the corner in time to see their comrade's limp body strike the floor behind the blur that was Mark Smythe. The taller of the two swung a nightstick that Mark deflected, twisting it free of the Arab's hand as he reversed its course, striking his head with the sound of a baseball bat hitting a watermelon. The second man dived for the Beretta, and Mark jumped on top of him, his hands closing around the fellow's wrists as he grabbed the gun handle. The Arab kicked and writhed in Mark's grasp, tried to twist his gun hand free, then screamed as he felt both wrists snap in the crushing grip of the one who held him. The Beretta clattered to the concrete floor. In desperation, the Arabic fighter sought to bring his knee up into Mark's groin, but abandoned the attempt as Mark twisted the man's broken left wrist, bringing forth another gargling scream. Grabbing the handgun, Mark brought it to the man's head, a smooth trigger squeeze ending his struggles. The smell of gunpowder filled Mark's nose, rapidly overridden by the stink of bile and loose bowels, the coppery taste of blood mist on his tongue, the cloying after-effects of violent death. He'd experienced them before, and he had the uncomfortable feeling that it wouldn't be too long until he bathed in them again. Rapidly frisking the bodies, Mark found what he was hoping for. Two spare 9mm magazines. Ejecting the partially empty magazine, he compared its weight to that of the full ones. 3 rounds left. Mark slapped one of the full mags into the weapon, ripped the shirt off one of the bodies, fashioned it into a crude shoulder pouch to hold the spare magazines, and moved on. Jennifer sat in the corner of the last cell on the left. Eyes rolled back in her head, a vapid smile painted on her face.
Jen, snap out of it!
Mark's words and gentle shake only caused her to push weakly at him, reminding him of how, as a child, she'd resisted their dad's lifting her sleeping body from the car after a late-night family outing. Glancing down at her left arm, Mark spotted the needle tracks. Not only had they addicted his sister to heroin, they'd made sure to mark her as an addict. A fresh red haze colored Mark's vision as he lifted her gently in his arms.
Don't worry, Jen, he breathed in her ear. I'm going to get you out of here. And then I'm going to kill every one of those bastards.
Chapter 89. Heather felt the tremor from the first two explosions, making a quick approximation of their distance and direction as she pulled up a digital map of Fort Meade on the computer monitor. A slow smile spread across her face as she mentally penned the locations on the map. Jack.
As she'd anticipated, he was out there, had probably been preparing and waiting for days, if not weeks. Now he'd detected the emergency situation at the NSA prison and had initiated his own supporting attack, an attack designed to disrupt and confuse the government response. Returning her attention to the task at hand, she saw Mark walk out of Jennifer's cell, his sister's limp body cradled in his arms. A rapid scan of the other monitors showed the assault team on the fourth sublevel fighting for survival. They'd lost three team members, and the remaining two were pinned down in the disabled elevator. Heather shifted focus to the ground floor. Team two had just finished placing a small explosive charge on the stairwell door and had backed off in preparation to blow the bolt. Pulling up another control panel, Heather activated fire alarms on the ground floor and first two sublevels, initiating their water sprinkler systems. The sprinkler layout didn't include the rooms with critical electronic and computing systems, those having halon gas fire suppression systems similar to that of the Master Control Center. The concussion from the stairwell detonation vibrated the camera display, completely knocking out the top camera in the main stairwell. Her fingers flying across the keyboard, she found the personnel data files, opening the profiles of the five most senior officials assigned to the facility. As she'd hoped, one of them was a woman. It took her less than 2 seconds to memorize the file. Glancing at the desk-mounted microphone, Heather pursed her lips in frustration. Useless. That system was hardwired to the loudspeakers in the prison section, sublevels 3 and 4, and couldn't be rerouted. She had no intention of letting the security team get down to the third sublevel.
Shit.
Heather shifted her attention to the laptop to the right of the station at which she currently sat. Not perfect, but it would have to do. Moving into the adjacent chair, Heather bypassed the login and began shifting control of the public address system that covered the ground floor, the stairwells, and the laboratories and offices on sublevels 1 and 2. It took her exactly 38 seconds.
Heather, you there?
Mark's thoughts nudged her mind.
Give me a minute.
Heather ran a quick check, adjusting the laptop microphone calibration. Then she went live.
Attention all security elements. This is Rebecca Faring. Badge number X-ray Kilo Niner 57 Zulu. Return immediately to the main floor and prepare to repel external attack. I say again, return immediately to the main floor and prepare to repel external attack. Faring out.
As she watched the ground floor monitor outside the main stairwell, another 20 seconds passed with no indication the stairwell team had heard the message. Then two of the black-clad team emerged into the main hallway, covering left and right as the rest of the team spilled back out of the stairwell and raced down the hallway toward the building entrance.
Okay, Mark, bring her down the first corridor on your left, then take the second right. I'm in the first room on the left.
Shouldn't you meet us at the stairwell?
We're not taking the stairwell, and I have a couple of things to finish up before we abandon ship.
On my way.
Just then, the ground shuddered with three more explosions, much closer than the first two. As the vibrations faded away, a fresh smile tweaked the corners of Heather's lips.
Jack, I'd like to kiss you long and hard, right here and now.
Chapter 90. Jack tore open the packaging around the prepaid cell phone and dialed the 404 area code number.
Thank you for calling HLN, a CNN network. If you are calling with a breaking news tip, please press 1.
Jack pressed 1, then pressed 1 again to speak to the news tip team. When a real person answered, Jack flipped the remaining 3 switches to arm, pressing the detonate buttons in rapid sequence as the lights turned green. Just over 3 miles away, the sound of the explosions began propagating outward, beginning the 17-second trip to his hotel room.
Be silent, infidel. My name is Farik Abdullah Muhammad. At this very moment, Allah has launched an attack on your National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, where our brothers are being held in a secret U.S. prison. If you listen closely, You may hear the explosions as I speak.
On cue, the shock waves arrived, rattling the windows and shaking pictures on the wall.
It has begun. Allahu Akbar.
Without waiting for a response, he hung up the phone, placed it on a white hand towel on the floor, and crushed it beneath his heel. Rolling the pieces inside the towel, Jack placed it beside his laptop in the soft leather valise, and added the remote detonator. Then, strapping on his shoulder holster and knife, he took one last sip of coffee, lifted the valise, and strolled out into the night.
Chapter 91.
Excuse me, Mr. President. I'm sorry to wake you, but we have a serious situation.
The telephone did little to soften James Noble's gravelly voice. President Jackson looked at the telephone, glanced over at Letitia's sleeping body, which only moments before had been spooned up against his, and sighed. God, he missed those peaceful nights with his wife. The ones before he got his wish and was made president.
Okay, James, give me the bad news.
It was always bad news, at least at this time of night. Nobody ever woke the President of the United States at 1 a.m. to say, "Good news, Mr. President, nothing bad has happened so far today."
There's been an attack at Fort Meade.
The NSA?
Yes, Mr. President.
Sudden depression threatened to cloud his mind, but the president forced himself to get out of bed.
Damn it. Get the National Security Council rounded up. I'll be down in 5 minutes.
I'm on it.
Oh, James, get General Wilson on the line.
Already working on it, Mr. President.
By the time President Jackson walked into the White House Situation Room, three members of the National Security Staff were already waiting for him. Corey Mayfield, James Nobles, and his chief of staff, Carol Owens.
Stay seated, President Jackson slid into his own chair. Who's got the rundown?
I guess I have the honor, James Nobles said. As I said on the phone, we've had reports of multiple explosions at Fort Meade, as well as gunfire near the NSA headquarters building. I have the NSA director on the line, but before you put him on, Mr. President, I think you should see this.
The National Security Advisor leaned forward and touched a button on the remote control panel, turning one of the flat panel displays to CNN.
As we continue to follow the situation underway at Fort Meade, Maryland, we continue to receive reports of explosions and gunfire coming from the base. As we've been reporting for the last several minutes, this station received a call from a person claiming to be a member of the Al-Qaeda cell conducting the attack. If you've just tuned in, I want you to listen to this recording of the call.
Several moments of dead air, which lasted just long enough to increase President Jackson's sense of foreboding, were suddenly broken by a man's heavily accented voice.
Be silent, infidel. My name is Farik Abdul Mohammed. At this very moment, Allah has launched an attack on your National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, where our brothers are being held in a secret U.S. prison. If you listen closely, you may hear the explosions as I speak.
The man paused as the sound of three distant explosions sounded in the background.
It has begun. Allahu Akbar.
James Nobles clicked a button and the video froze.
They've been recycling this recording every couple of minutes.
President Jackson nodded, then pressed a button on the speakerphone.
General Wilson, this is President Jackson. Can you hear me okay?
There was a 2-second pause, followed by an encryption hiss, as Balls Wilson's voice came over the speaker.
Loud and clear, Mr. President. Sorry for the comlink delay, but we're having to talk over a secure SATCOM link.
The president tried and failed to keep the irritation out of his voice.
And why is that?
Someone's taken out our external phone lines, killed base military police radio comms as well. We've also got some sort of problem inside the ICE house.
So who's behind it?
The consensus view says Al-Qaeda. I'm not buying it.
Have you seen the news?
I've seen it.
Seems cut and dried to me.
Too cut and dried, Mr. President. Levi doesn't think it's Al-Qaeda either. No chatter match.
Corey Mayfield cut in.
Bullshit, Mr. President. Sometimes things are exactly what they seem.
And sometimes they aren't.
General Wilson's voice acquired a cutting edge.
So what's your situation right now?
President Jackson interrupted. Christ, did every president have to endure such constant bickering among his advisors?
Mass confusion. I just got back to the NSA and the building is secure. Our perimeter defense force is in place and ready to repel an attack. But the military police are having problems. I haven't been able to raise the MP station, and apparently they can't communicate with any of their patrols. We've had multiple explosions around the base, so you can imagine what the night shift patrols are doing, trying to get to the places where the bombs went off. We've also lost communications with the Ice House facility.
Response teams?
They've got their own, just like we do here.